Hey everybody, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. It's good to have you here with us. Been a little while since we did the show, been 2 weeks. I turned 40 in the meantime since we've last had a conversation, so I am now in decade five of life, which is kind of hard to believe. You can get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy, on Instagram at the same name, Ryan Ballingy. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. All my stuff's available at thegolfnewsnet.com. And today we've got a bunch of different things to kind of talk about. I wanted to start with actually the Wells Fargo Championship and kind of go over not necessarily Wyndham Clark winning. I mean, that's part of it, but where we are at with the designated events. And then we'll talk a little bit about what's going on with the DP World Tour, the sanctions that they handed out to players who went and played the LIV event last year. And a little bit about that. And then I do want to wrap up the show with part one of an interview around putters and putting that I think at least was really fascinating to me. And both parts will be available on our equipment podcast, The Bag Room, this week, but wanted to play it for you. So it's not all just me talking for 60 straight minutes, but to have a really interesting conversation. So we'll preface that in the third and final segment of this week's show. So let's talk about designated events. We had our latest designated event on this year's schedule, the Wells Fargo Championship this week. And I'm talking from a strict data perspective, strict numbers perspective. The interest was not very good, even compared to prior years of this tournament. Last year, I think people were paying attention for a couple of different reasons. One, they were paying attention because it was at TPC Potomac. It was at a different venue, and that was awkward. I think people enjoyed watching the guys trudge through the rain a little bit. I think it helped that Max Homa, who is a pretty popular player among at least very online golf observers, was in contention, and that the end was pretty interesting because you had Cameron Young and Matt Fitzpatrick as part of it. So there was a lot to work with there. It did not feel that way, and no offense to Wyndham Clark, who played great golf, had been trending in this direction, and absolutely deserved to win by four. He played the best golf by far of the week, but it just felt flat. And May is a tough month for golf. It really is. If you look at if you pulled back the curtain of Golf News Net in terms of the best months for people paying attention to golf, May would be fifth. Like, April's number one. June and July, battle for number two. August is third or fourth. And then May is fifth. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why the come down from the Masters is so hard that May is that bad. But the result has not been particularly great for the PGA Championship. I mean, that's the one thing that holds this month up in terms of general interest. And I assume it will again next week at Oak Hill. But the difficulty, I think, is real in trying to get people to care after the biggest golf tournament of the year. You had a designated event in the back half of April with Harbortown and the RBC Heritage, and that's great. I mean, that was really well watched, well, lots of interest behind it. And having a playoff between two really good players also certainly helps. But then after that, you've got the Zurich Classic, which I love the concept, but the execution just has not worked yet. I don't know what has to change, but I love the concept of the team event. It just doesn't catch people's attention. You had the Mexico Open, where positively no one cared about, at least more broadly speaking, about the results. And that's primarily because you only had two players really who could win in the field, and those two players were 1 and 2, just like they were last year. And then you had this past week where you had Wells Fargo. I don't think a lot of people even knew it was a designated event. And you had the top two players in the world skip it because Scottie Scheffler's playing this week at the Byron Nelson because, like a good Texan does, apparently, he is playing in all the Texas events. And so he needed one to skip. That was one. And John Rahm didn't play because he defended the Mexico Open title and did that very honorably, but didn't want to have more and more golf leading into the PGA Championship. So he played that event and took this week off, and we won't see him this week. We'll see him again at the PGA Championship next week. So it just kind of felt like, well, if those guys aren't playing, then why should anyone care? And obviously Rory McIlroy cared, 37, I think it was, the world top 50, cared to show up and play. And that's not that far off from what we had in other designated tournaments where you had 40 to 44 of the world top 50 competing. And that was at a time when there were still a few more LIV players in the top 50 than there are now. You had one Thomas Peters fall out last week. You'll have one more fall out this week. So I think there are only four top 50 players in the official World Golf Ranking remaining from LIV. And even someone like Brooks Koepka and Patrick Reed, those guys earned points, obviously, a lot of points by doing well in the Masters, but they're still going to drop off really heavily because they're up against the minimum divisor in the world ranking, and they're not earning points otherwise except the majors that they compete in. So it feels like there is some juice missing, and I don't know if people dislike Quail Hollow. I think Quail Hollow is fine. I don't have anything against it or, frankly, anything for it, but I don't have anything against it. And it doesn't seem like a lot of people dislike it, but it just doesn't have the kind of draw that maybe Johnny Morris wants, or maybe the folks at Quail Hollow want, or the folks at Wells Fargo want, whatever it is. Just doesn't do it. I don't know what's going to work. But moving forward, it sounds like the PGA Tour has every intention of keeping whatever they come up with as the designated docket pretty permanent, pretty parked. And that sounds like at least three of the four added non-invitational events are going to become designated. Sounds like Wells Fargo is going to be one of them. Sounds like the Travelers Championship is going to be one of them. What we don't know is if Harbortown is going to remain one. My guess is up in the air about that. And then Jack Nicklaus kind of let the cat out of the bag, whether that's true in the end or not, or comes to pass in the end or not. But he said at the Honda Classic that Phoenix will go back to being a regular event because it's Phoenix. It doesn't need anything. And they're going to take Pebble Beach and turn that into a designated event, which would permanently alter the course of the Clambake, where you would have a tournament that historically had players with professionals with AMs. And for the last, I don't know what number of years, but 156 of them between three courses over 3 days, that may turn into a two-day pro-am and a weekend on Pebble Beach with just professionals, which can change the character of the tournament while you still have the pro-am component. Maybe you charge more money for the AMs to compete, so you more or less make up to where you were in terms of the money that was raised for charity. But we shall see, I guess. That's all still very much to be determined. It's going to be an interesting time, whatever happens there. I think they're making a mistake in doing this, keeping them permanent, or more or less permanent, even though these are some of the biggest sponsors in golf. I mean, AT&T sponsors two tournaments. They sponsor this weekend and Pebble. They're huge into golf. And Randall Stephenson is on the board of the PGA Tour, so duh. And Travelers has spent insane amounts of money building up the Travelers Championship from what used to be the Greater Hartford Open into something that routinely attracts great players because they kind of sort of pay players for appearances, but not for appearances to play golf, but to show up at other events. And they offer all kinds of other stuff that's nice, like childcare and family-friendly stuff for the players' families and things like that. So they've spent a lot of time and money building this event. I get it. What about RBC? RBC sponsors two tournaments on the PGA Tour. They sponsor Harbortown, they sponsor the Canadian Open, and they sponsor a lot of PGA Tour players with patches on their shoulders or other clothing. So that is kind of part of the deal. They're compelled to play those two events. Well, if they're willing to spend the money to do that, then surely they're willing to spend the money to be a designated tournament. So maybe Harbortown stays that way. I don't know if they move in the schedule, but maybe they do it that way. And you got to keep the Canadian Open, I think, as a true open tournament, even though it's not really. But keep it as one because of the National Open's history and how important it is to Canadian golf. And they're just not going to turn that into a designated tournament. So The challenge, I think, beyond identifying what the ones are going to be next year moving forward, is do you take one or even two of them and decide to move them around? Like, you make net new tournaments, and they, you can call them new things or call them old things, whatever, but you move them around. And what they have tried so hard to do with the players, make it feel like a major, and it is a very important golf tournament and well revered, but it's one that stays parked. And that is intentional because they want it to feel kind of like the Masters. Well, if they want to have the correlation that it's kind of a major like tournament, even if you're going to have a limited field or very small cut, then I think you need to move it around because the other majors move around. And you could take these tournaments to places in the country and throughout the world. I think they should do that. But take it to places that don't have a regular PGA Tour event. I mean, the DC area loves golf, and we get one-off events, and they're well-attended, and then they go away. And then they're like, oh, yeah, we should bring a tournament back to DC. Let's give it a terrible date, and no one comes because it's hotter than hell here in July. So no wonder people don't want to show up and watch a tournament in 100-degree weather. And that's their solution. They take it away and go find someplace else. So for a venue like, or a market like ours, or even they're not in New York or Boston regularly, take a tournament up there and have something that moves around. Have one that moves around the northeast portion of the United States, and have one that moves around the Midwest and Pacific Northwest of the United States. Just move it around. Just city to city to city. Portland, Seattle, Denver, whatever. Pick your places. But do that. Salt Lake City, I don't care. But move it around, and you're going to get such a great live crowd and reception. When they brought the BMW Championship to Baltimore, that place was lubed up and amazing. And they did it again in Wilmington, in Delaware. And people complain in the Chicago market that they don't have a regular PGA Tour event. I completely understand that. Chicago's a great golf town. But the reception that this tournament gets when it moves to places that don't or have never seen a PGA Tour event is off the wall. Why can there not be a tournament like that? There can be three on the tour. You have one for the Midwest, one, and that can be your BMW Championship, one in the Northeast / Mid-Atlantic, and one in the Pacific Northwest. Bang. You got just raucous, awesome crowds. You can find national sponsors or international sponsors that don't necessarily feel so important to have to entertain clients in a specific place because of their headquarters, for example, and let it rip. But if you keep doing this thing where you have tournaments that are at venues or courses that are and you just call them designated tournaments because they have a big purse and they have a solid enough field, I think that's going to cause trouble, especially next year, because there's not going to be a player requirement. If you take money from the PIP, the Player Impact Program, which is basically an enormous pool of money paid out to the most popular players. First of all, that pool is going down from $100 million last year to $50 million. So this was a one-time $50 million payoff to 23 players to convince them to stay on the PGA Tour in part. Now we're going, and the exchange was, we're going to give you this extra money, but in exchange for that extra money, you're going to play every designated tournament for which you are eligible except one, or you forfeit 25% at least of your money from the PIP program. Well, McIlroy forfeited $3 million for missing Harbortown, his second of the year. Rahm and Scheffler found their event to skip. So did Matsuyama, found their event to skip. So they're good for the year. And they're doing their requirements this year. Next year, it's different. There is no playing requirement. You don't have to show up to any of them if you don't want. Now, I think you would be foolish to not play in a $20 million purse tournament. But I'm sure there are going to be a couple of guys who skip two, and they're not going to be penalized for it against the PIP money that they can collect. And that's going to cause, I think, a commotion. It's going to cause a problem because these events come along and they're limited to certain players, and I'm sure they'll have reserves and all those things. But these events are going to be built for the best players to cash in, and they're going to keep out a lot of the rank and file. So if those guys, you know, let's say some catastrophe happens and 10 of them choose not to play a designated event, then it's going to look really bad when they pump in the next 10 guys like, well, here's your shot, and then try to explain that to fans. But if you can, at a venue you play every year, but if you say to the players, hey, look, we're going to take you to a classic golf course, great club, great town, we'll take care of you, you're going to have amazing crowds all week, you're playing for $20 million, then yes, now you might have something on your hands that works better for everybody. I hope that is where they go with this, because I don't think Quail Hollow has the juice to really create much buzz, even with a big purse and nearly 40 of the world top 50 coming to compete. I just don't think it does. And that's not a knock on the tournament. They do a really good job. It just doesn't seem to connect. May's a really hard time of year. And if I were the PGA Tour, I'd almost lean into that by going, look, and they kind of do already, but even more so, look, we need a week off here. Like, we can do Harbor Town and we can do one more event and have the Zurich Classic as kind of a fun week, but just have one dark week. Just don't play golf. It might be better. People start to miss it after a little while. Even a week where there's not golf. Like, oh, well, golf's back this week. It was off last week. It happens. So that's just my thinking about the designated tournaments. In general, I really like them. I think they're lovely. And I think they have been good. But it has also been to the diminishment of the regular events and how they're going to handle this moving forward without a player requirement. I am not convinced will be exactly the same as what they've done this year. And I think for it to be successful, it's got to be pretty close to the same as what they've seen this year. So that's one part of it. And then what happens with LIV? Because all of this stuff was created in response to LIV. And I haven't seen LIV talk once about how many people are watching their tournaments, other than the first one. And the first one was not great. The second one was 30% worse, 30% down. And then I'm sure it was worse for the ones that were overseas because they were on tape delay. So the television numbers had to have been putrid. And the one in Orlando, Brooks Koepka won. So it might have gotten some people, but I don't think a ton. So all of the numbers are bad. Are they going to keep doing this? Are they going to keep doing this for years on end and just letting themselves get spanked in the ratings, even against bad PGA Tour events by which they are competing and still losing? I'm not convinced of that. So in a world where LIV might go away or get reabsorbed back into the PGA Tour, at least some of their players, how's that all going to work? Do those guys get a piece of the pie? Or are they kicked out of designated tournaments for 1, 2, 3, you know, however long they were on LIV? How's that work? I think that's something to consider. And I don't know. That's something in the back burner. But we haven't talked about that in a while because it's just kind of presumed that the PGA Tour won. The existential crisis is over. Whoever was going to leave left. Some of them already have buyer's remorse and have publicly expressed that to some degree. And others in private are kind of like, what the heck is this? What are we doing here? Other than the money, which obviously they like. So that's a whole other thing, whole other discussion for another time. But the designated tournament thing has largely been a success. It just felt like this past weekend was maybe not as much of one as the others. All right, let's get into the DP World Tour stuff. So it's been an interesting couple of weeks, really week, I suppose, for the DP World Tour. They formalized a partnership with the Korean PGA Tour to bump up their investment in the Korean market with a couple of tournaments. In exchange, they're going to allow a couple of their points list holders, the Korean points list holders, to move up to the DP World Tour next season for the next couple seasons. And that's a nice arrangement, but that's not really what I'm talking about. The news here is that the DP World Tour is finally taking action against players who went and competed on LIV or left for LIV entirely, but at least competed in the first event last year, about a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago now, 13 months ago, when they had their first event at the Centurion Club outside of London. And there were 17 players who went over to that event from the DP World Tour membership base, and that none of them were given permission to do so by the DP World Tour. They have the same kind of, it's called a conflicting tournament or conflicting event release system as the PGA Tour. It's not exactly the same, but it's pretty close. And basically, if you want to play off of or away from your tour, you have to have some kind of approval. For the PGA Tour, you can do it, I think it's 3 times a year. For basically every 5 events that you play on the PGA Tour, you can have a conflicting event release. So if you play 20 or 25 times, all right, then you can have up to 5 releases, but hardly anyone does that because almost all of the big money is there on the PGA Tour. That's a little bit different than the DP World Tour. You could be a member of the DP World Tour as an associate member and just kind of play and come and go as you please with really no playing requirements to maintain membership. Or you can be a full member, and then you have your own playing requirements to basically play outside of the co-sanctioned events with the United States, with the PGA Tour being like, used to be the WGCs and the majors, now it's just the WGCs, or excuse, just the majors. So, a little bit slightly different. But still, yes, if you're going to go play a tour that you're not a member of, or don't claim as like a permanent tour, then you have to say, hey, we want to play this event, will you let us play it? And they're like, yeah, okay. Or, no, don't. And in this case, they said, no, don't. Or some of them just didn't ask. They just did it. And that meant that they violated the rules of their membership, which when you join a tour, you don't just say, like, oh, I'm a member now, and you get, like, a name badge. You sign a legally binding agreement. And the legally binding agreement is obviously slightly different from tour to tour, but, like, the PGA Tour, you basically sign away your marketing rights so that the tour can market everybody on the tour and not just some of you. And that's the thing that Phil Mickelson complained about. And then you have a similar idea on the DP World Tour. Like, you give your marketing rights over so everybody can be marketed. You can market the whole tour as a collective. And that you also agree to fulfilling membership requirements. So you got to not have, you know, you got to have conflicting event releases. You got to play a certain number of tournaments. You've got to do this, that, and the other. You can't wear certain kinds of sponsor patches. You can't do this. You can't write bad checks. There's all kinds of random requirements that are in the member agreement. And the DP World Tour and the PGA Tour have penalty structures built in to their contracts with the players that in the event they violate them, there's a sanction. There's some kind of penalty. And so the PGA Tour can make up theirs. The DP World Tour can make up theirs. PGA Tour's penalty was basically, you go play for LIV, you're suspended. You can't play any single PGA Tour event until you make good, and we'll tell you what that looks like. On the DP World Tour, they said, as this relates to the Scottish Open last year, a bunch of DP World Tour players or that went to LIV wanted to play because they still, at that time, had DP World Tour membership, and that's a co-sanctioned event with the PGA Tour. Keith Pelley was not going to be allowed, and I say that quite literally, be allowed to make that happen from Jay Monahan's perspective. And so the DP World Tour said to their guys, no, you can't play. You are sanctioned, you are prohibited. And they took it to an arbitration board, they gave them an emergency ruling really quickly and said, no, they can play until this thing's heard out in full. That's going to be a while. They can stay members and play until then. Now, those guys didn't really want to play a full DP World Tour schedule. They knew they had signed with LIV. They knew they contractually, at least with LIV, had to play every single LIV event. So last year, all 8, this year, all 14. And they didn't have really any say in their schedule outside of those, you know, those weeks. They really had no say in their schedule. They were playing LIV. They agreed to it. That's what the money was for. But outside of those weeks, those 14 tournaments, they might want to consider playing in, let's say, the British Masters, for example, or the BMW PGA Championship, or the most lucrative Rolex series events where, yeah, it's not a $20 million individual purse, but hey, $10 million ain't bad, or $9 million ain't bad. I'll go play for that. And they wanted to really have their cake and eat it too in a world where they had a contract to make it effectively a closed system for 90% of the players, and no one was going to come in and take their spot. And they wanted to come in and take money from the DP World Tour. And they're regulars. And that didn't look very good. So, of course, the DP World Tour defended their turf. And the arbitration case got heard. Meanwhile, most of these guys that were on LIV permanently really didn't make the move over, hardly ever, to play a DP World Tour event. Probably because of bad optics. Not good, no goodwill between players that stuck around and the players that left. Stuff like that. But the case was heard in February. The ruling was given out in, I think April, early April, late March, somewhere there. And the ruling was in favor of the DP World Tour, that the penalty that they imposed, or wanted to impose, a £100,000 fine for playing that event, that one specific event, could be upheld, and that it wasn't over the top and it wasn't against the rules or anything like that. So the DP World Tour came out last week, first announcing that four players, Richard Bland, Ian Poulter, Sergio Garcia, and Lee Westwood, had resigned their membership, and that they would not be eligible to play in the Ryder Cup or participate in any way as long as they're not DP World Tour members. And that was kind of their way of saying, hey, we'll pay the one fine, but we're out of here. And that's it. And then a couple of days later, they went and announced that 16 of 17 players who played with DP World Tour membership that went and played that first live event at Centurion Club, they had paid a £100,000 fine for doing so. And that included a bunch of players who are no longer on live. That included a bunch of players who were one-offs or two-offs or three-offs, but they didn't sign a contract to be a live player. And so they, if they didn't finish well, you get, I think it's $120,000 for dead last place in a live event. That's still true. So if you finished, and I don't remember the standings for that event, so you'll have to forgive me. But if basically you finished worse than the top, say, 30, you pretty much just paid all that money back to the DP World Tour as a fine. And they collected £1.6 million. And the one person who didn't pay the fine yet and has apparently no intention of paying said fine is Sergio Garcia. And Garcia has made it clear, according to the DP World Tour, he's never going to pay that fine, even though Liv has said that they that Liv would be willing to pay legal fees and fines levied against them by other former tours. And this is just a petty thing. Garcia doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want them to pay the fine. He doesn't want to give them the satisfaction, I guess. I don't know. It's kind of weird. 16 to 17 did, so I assume at some point he will. But the DP World Tour has then said, okay, well, we're also going to announce further sanction. And that's coming up sometime this week. So they let the weekend go by. I assume we'll hear something that, you know, in the next few days. And there will be more sanction for those players. Now, what that looks like, I don't know. I don't know if they're going to just take the £100,000 fine and call it a day and let the likes of Westwood, Garcia, Bland, and Poulter go away, or they're going to, how they're going to do it. Because I don't think that they could reasonably go and fine players who played more live events on the DP World Tour without fining those guys who signed agreements. So I don't know what that all looks like. But this is it. Like, this is clearly with the consequences of these players' actions coming to roost. And Westwood, for his part, acted like he was totally shocked that this happened and that DP World Tour fined him and would probably continue fining him for every event that he played that is not sanctioned, not given a competing event release, and that he'd have to pay out the wazoo for it. He didn't want to do that. And so he said, oh, I can't believe it came down to this, and they're basically throwing away 25 years and blah, 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 blah. And on one hand, I get it. He's played the DP World Tour basically his entire adult life. And it's been a multiple time Order of Merit winner, became world number one, all under that banner, was a great Ryder Cup player. And all of that is true, and all of that can be true. And at the same time, it's also true that all of the major tours in the world that didn't like the development of LIV, namely the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour, said, hey, if you go and play there, we are going to penalize you. And it is not going to be a minor one. It's going to be a steep penalty. And then Westwood and Poulter and, I mean, Poulter was on full swing. The documentary, the docuseries, talking about his move to LIV and how it was great for his family and blah, blah. He knew all of that information. No one was like, hey, surprise, guess what? You're getting screwed. They didn't say that. And they weren't going to say that. They told him up front what the consequences were going to be just so they were aware. And that I think that the DP World Tour knew, look, this is going to be just a parting shot out the door because they're not coming back. All these guys that, I mean, that were mentioned, they're in their 40s. They're on the tail end of their careers. They took the money for a very specific age-related reason. And they got paid going out the door. And so the DP World Tour wasn't going to just let them walk. They made them pay them what amounts to, in the grand scheme of things compared to their contracts, probably a very minor fine. And that's it. And if it all goes away, if LIV all goes away and there's some kind of room for reconciliation, I don't think the DP World Tour is against that. I mean, they put a little pithy line in their press release saying, oh, we thank Ian and Sergio and Lee, but not Richard Bland because he never played the Ryder Cup, for their efforts and service into building the Ryder Cup and the legacy of that. I don't think they're trying to burn the bridge. It's as much as maybe the LIV guys are, and trying to say, well, you know, we put all this and we're hurt. You're not hurt. You're not hurt. You knew what was coming. And to go and do this dog and pony show out in public of feeling maligned, and when people literally told you that was going to happen, being shocked and appalled, don't do that. That's not worthwhile. We are at the point in all of this that LIV exists for however long it's going to exist. 2 more years, 1 year, 10 years, 50 years, whatever it is. But it's out there and it's doing its thing. However it does it. And the DP World Tour is still out there doing its own thing. They have decided, look, we can't compete with the PGA Tour. And oh, by the way, they can't. I want to talk about that for a second. Because there are a lot of people who are backers of LIV who love to spew the talking point that Keith Pelley is killing the European Tour, killing the DP World Tour, because he's creating a feeder system to the PGA Tour. There's a reason he's doing that. Because he can't win. He can't win against the PGA Tour, and he sure as hell can't win against two tours with bigger resources in different fashions than the DP World Tour. He can't. He can't beat the PGA Tour already. That was done and dusted. Now you've got the Saudis, who are willing to spend quite literally billions of dollars to get a tour off the ground. Who do you think Keith Pelley is going to talk to about trying to build up a sponsor base to have more than a handful of Rolex Series tournaments for $8, $9, $10 million? Who? Nobody. It's done. It's over. So you pick your camp. You either make your agreement with the PGA Tour, which is what he did. You recognize you're fundamentally a feeder system, save for 6 or 7 tournaments a year that maybe someday wind up just merging into one big tour, and those get absorbed in the PGA Tour schedule, and that's it. Or you do what he didn't do, which is take and consider LIV's offer to buy the DP World Tour for $1 billion or whatever it was, and sell it the history of European golf, because once the Saudis get bored with it, which they inevitably do in so many other projects, then they're just going to sell it to somebody else for cents on the dollar and ruin the DP World Tour that way. How do you want it to crumble down? Do you want it to crumble down quickly and in a fashion you can't contain, but someone gets paid some of the $1 billion that gets paid out? Or do you try to survive and build a relationship with the PGA Tour, knowing your place in the golf world is what it is? It's a no-win, I understand. But I think he made the right choice in the long haul. And there might come a day where the DP World Tour can rise back up. And they back out of that agreement. And they say, yeah, you can go play the PGA Tour, but guess what? We've got a lot of great stuff going on here. But in the meanwhile, he doesn't have the financial resources to beat two tours. Just doesn't. So that's in part why all this stuff is happening. That's why a clear world order, so to speak, has been made between the tours that aren't LIV. Because everyone kind of knows how it's working. And if it were not for the Saudis coming into golf, I'm not even sure the Asian Tour would exist right now. They have committed something like $300 million over 10 years to put on half of the significant Asian Tour schedule. The Asian Tour just had an event this week in South Korea. They don't play again for a month and a half. Month and a half! Can you imagine what that schedule would look like if there weren't an international series of events? And I'll pull this up here, and I'm just thinking about this right now. Should have had this prepared, so I'm sorry for you hearing the clicking of my mouse pulling up the schedule. But if you look at the Asian Tour schedule this year, just to this point, so we're in the beginning of May, they have played 8 events so far. 4 of them are international series events. 4 of them. And 2 of them are at former DP World Tour venues. Throw in the Saudi International, which is a former DP World Tour event. They brought 3 DP World Tour events over. Then you have 2 new international series events. They brought that over. that's basically the entire first half of the year schedule. Rest of the year, international series events, you've got five of them. You've got one in England at Close House, which is Lee Westwood's club, by the way. You've got one at the Fairmont St. Andrews, which was a former DP World Tour venue during COVID. That's another. You've got the Singapore event. You've got the Hong Kong Open, which they moved from the DP World Tour. And you've got the Indonesian Masters, which has come back because of it being a part of the international series, even though it's not technically called that. So half of the Asian Tour schedule is international series. All the other events, look at some of the purses. Macau Open, $1 million. Yanjer TPC, $750,000. The Delhi Golf Club Open, $750,000. The World City Championship presented by Hong Kong Golf Club. I mean, a golf club in Hong Kong is paying for it. $1 million. If it were not for the Saudis, the Asian Tour is dead. Done and dusted. Gone. They brought it back from the dead. That's why that agreement exists, because they agreed and realized that if LIV goes away, they'll still be around. And even then, I'm not sure that even holds up that well. So that's why that exists, okay? The Saudis are holding up they've brought up a lot of money into golf, and they want to keep it in their sandbox, in their space, right? They're under their control. And in the other sandbox is everybody else. And that's the way it's going to be. And if the Saudis choose to walk away from investing in golf because it hasn't done enough for them, and I don't know what the metric they decide that, but let's say they get rid of LIV. Well, now you're going to have to build out the sandbox again, and you're going to have to take on not only LIV players. You're not going to have to only take them on. You're probably going to have to consider taking over the Asian Tour, because that's the next step. Unless the Saudis are like, yeah, we totally failed at LIV, but we're going to keep investing that $300 million we promised into the Asian Tour. I don't expect that to happen. There's no reason for that to continue if the Saudis aren't interested in LIV and creating a feeder system by the Asian Tour. This is a big deal. So the DP World Tour made its choice. They're where they're at. It's okay that it's there, and we move on. But don't go out the door thinking that you have to give a big, long speech about how the DP Tour did you wrong. The DP World Tour / European Tour made you what you are, gave you access to the Ryder Cup, gave you an international stage to be a star, gave you access to the major championships, and did all kinds of stuff for you so that you had a 25-year career that was pretty amazing. And oh, by the way, made you famous enough that LIV said we'll pay you an exorbitant amount of money above and beyond what you're probably worth in this day and age to play on our tour for 2, 3, or 4 years. Maybe some gratitude would be pretty decent. All right, let's do the interview. We got a little emotional there. Not too emotional, but a little emotional. But let's talk about something equally emotional. Putting. All of us are golf nuts. If you're listening to this show, if you're listening to any golf podcast, you really love golf. And you probably have had some experience of frustration playing golf. Whatever facet of the game that is. For a lot of people, they struggle with putting. Putting's really, really hard. And as I think Ben Hogan properly noted many years ago, there are two different games at work here, where full swing golf is its own thing and putting is its own thing. They're two completely different skill sets in many, many ways. And the one skill set, putting, is extremely frustrating for a lot of people. And part of that reason, according to our next guest, who is Sam Hahn, the CEO of Lab Golf, Lie Angle Balanced Golf, is because we've been told the wrong stuff about how putters work and how putting works and what we need to do to optimize our putting stroke and with the equipment that we use on the greens to work together to make more putts more often. Obviously, everyone makes 18 in a round if you're playing 18 holes, but that you take fewer putts and you feel more comfortable and you're more on target and you lower your scores. And so I had this conversation with Sam a few weeks ago, and I'm only going to air about half of it. I think it was about a 45-minute discussion. And we were just kind of talking about how the company came along and how he got involved. And he's a really good golfer. I think he's was like a plus three at some point. I mean, better than I am ever, probably could ever hope to be even. And he really got into understanding putters. And it almost drove him away from the game. And then he found Lab Golf and their directed force putter. And that putter was really the first thing that caught people's attention about the company. Adam Scott used the putter and really caught some eyes because people were like, what's that thing? And now they have really used that. They've leveraged that to become a bigger, slightly more conventional looking putter company with a couple of different putter options. And the whole idea of being lie angle balanced is that the putter doesn't twist when you putt it. So when you putt, generally speaking, you're trying to control twist. You're trying to control the rotational twist that the putter wants to have in your hands, and also how it handles torque and how you get through the putt and how you square it up to your target and all that stuff. What Lab claims is that their putters stay square to the target, they don't move, and that you're going to hit more consistent putts. And a lot of people that they've seen in terms of reviews or professionals or influential people in the golf world have said they've seen those kinds of results. So I didn't want to necessarily talk just about the claims around what their technology does. I mean, I think that's interesting, and that'll be a different conversation for another time. But I wanted to talk with Sam just about putting, about forming a company. Well, he didn't form it, but joining a company, being a super fan effectively, and then getting into the company, becoming the CEO, taking it in a new direction in some sense, and what he's kind of out to prove in all of this. And I did not know what to expect when we started the conversation, but at the end of it, 45 minutes in, and I kind of had to cut it off, I was blown away, and I just really, really enjoyed it. So I hope you'll enjoy this half of it. The full conversation is available on our equipment podcast called The Bag Room. You can find that anywhere podcasts are found. You can listen to it on our website, golfnewsnet.com, or on Golf News Net Radio through iHeart and TuneIn. And I hope you enjoy this conversation with Sam Hahn.
You've always been located there? Are you an Oregonian for life? Or
I grew up in Chicago. Okay. I've been in Eugene for 22 years now. So quite a while. So yeah, I've been here longer than I was in Chicago. So I guess I'm officially an Oregonian.
And when did you start Lab Golf?
So I didn't found it. The inventors
of Lab Golf. Start with Lab Golf, I guess.
I started with Lab late 2017 is kind of when Bill and I started flirting with the idea. And then I think we were official kind of early 2018.
Okay.
And then we were rebranded as Lab by middle of 2018.
Gotcha. Okay. So what was it previously?
It's called Directed Force. The company was called Directed Force. And then, so
I didn't know the name of it. I knew of the Directed Force putter because of Adam Scott, I think. Putter,
yeah, he was using it in 2019. The Directed Force putter was called the Reno. The company was called Directed Force. And the model was, you know, the Reno 1.0, 2.0, and then 2.1. And that was when I came along. And the tech was there. I mean, it was very real. I stumbled into it and it changed my life. And then Bill and I became buddies through a really goofy set of circumstances. I bought the putter and it was absolutely blowing my mind. And I started to hear a bit of a rattle, and the rattle got louder, and then eventually the head fell off. And so I had to send it back. Bill called personally to apologize, and he and I just kind of hit it off, and we became friends. About, I guess it would have been 2 or 3 months after that, he was about to close the doors. They had, you know, all they had was the patent and a model, and the rest of it was really struggling. The branding, the marketing, the manufacturing, customer service, website, all of it just needed a whole new everything. So, we got to work right away on it in 2019 or 2018, and came up with a nice name and a nice brand and cool logos and all the stuff, and went from there.
Where did your involvement come in, or where were you? What were you doing previously before you got involved?
Nothing much related to what I'm doing now. other than that, I've always been promoting something my entire life. So I actually spent most of my life in the bar and music and entertainment business. So when I was in my late teens and early 20s, I was a touring musician, and and a couple of different bands I used to go around the country with. And I handled all of our booking and tour management. And I sort of parlayed that into a talent agency and so I was a talent buyer here in Eugene for a couple of different venues, one of them in particular for almost 13 years, sort of a small venue, small bar venue. And then about 7 years into that, I opened up my own place here in Eugene. And you know, it was a lot of night work. So I had nothing but time during the day to become a full certified golf, you know, crazy person, like a crazy person. And then, And then, like I said, ended up with the putter through a guy named Bob Duncan, who he lives in Bend now, has a very cool, teaching business called GPS. And, he introduced it to me. He'd found it in Australia, I think. And like I said, I had my experience with the putter that was, crazy. I mean, it was nuts. I think I was a one when I got the putter. And I was a plus 3.5 6 weeks later without doing anything other than making 8-foot putts instead of missing them.
You were obviously a very good player. You're very accomplished.
Yeah, I not so accomplished. I don't love competitive golf, but you know, around here and you know, in the Saturday morning games and all that stuff, I do pretty good. And yeah, I think the highest my handicap's been in the last 20 years has probably been 15 years anyway, has probably been 1.5 or so. And then the lowest I ever was at that 3.5 after I got my plus 3.5 after I got the directed force putter. And then when I got into business, all of a sudden all my daytime 36 whole days disappeared pretty instantly. So
did you get down so quickly to scratch over what, 2-3 years, or was it a longer slog?
Yeah, I played when I was little. My dad showed me how to, you know, hold the club and swing, and you know, we used to go out once or twice a month during the summer. And he actually joined a country club when I was in high school. So I got to play a little bit more, but I would just kind of go around and around. I was always crazy about the game. Like I always was super addicted to it. And, but I never actually studied the game, until I got out to Oregon. So when I got out to Oregon, I was probably an 18 handicap, something like that. and I'd had a hard time in the past, like finding, you know, like-minded folks to golf with. Like I'm not your standard golfing guy, you know, music business and you know, all that. So I met sort of this, like, you know, uber stony golfer who was like a four. He was like the first good player that I ever got to you know, play with. And that's really the only way to get better is to play with guys that are better than you and see how they do. I think about probably a year and a half later, I was a scratch player. 2 years later, I was a scratch player. I won a couple club championships at the Muni. And 18 years later, I actually just won one here at Emerald Valley. Our factory's on a golf course.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. It's awesome. Actually, there's a, you can't quite see it, but we actually got a little D3 tournament going on today.
Oh, look at that.
And it's a strong golf course. It's where the Ducks play.
Awesome.
And so we get access to them, which is awesome. Casey Martin's their coach, and he's been an incredible supporter of ours for pretty much since the beginning. All the kids are just so nice and always testing our stuff for us and giving us feedback. And then the course itself, for putting purposes in particular, is awesome. Very, very severe greens.
Yeah.
Very small, super slopey. You need to know how to roll it around here, and it's tight, and every hole's a dog leg of some kind, and big, you know, 150 foot tall fir trees guarding every fairway. And so, yeah, it's a good course. We were, the company started, Bill founded the company in Reno. For the first couple of years, I was running the company remotely from here in Eugene. Bill ultimately decided he wanted to didn't want to be handling the day-to-day stuff anymore, so we moved the factory up here to Eugene in January of 21. Moved into like a 4,000 or 5,000 square foot place. And that was right when we got some positive reviews from Peter Finch and Rick Shields. And our business tripled overnight. And
wow.
And we grew out of that space like within 3 months of being there. So for 2 years, we had to grind it out and everybody was on top of each other. I mean, literally our sales guys were, there was four of them in one room on the phone, all of them at the same time. I mean, the builders were, you know, shoulder to shoulder, the packing room. I mean, it was really, really chaotic. And then started to look around for some new spaces. And the building that we're in now, when this course was built back in the 60s or 70s or something, it was supposed to be a whole big thing. So they built a giant building that had a health club in it, an office space cool. upstairs and all that. And they've always struggled to kind of keep a tenant in here. And the health club, the fifth, for whatever, the many iterations of attempts at making this a legit health club later, they moved out and we asked the owner here if we could move in. And he was planning on tearing the building down. So we talked about that. And so, yeah, now we have 15,000 square feet with room to grow even more if we want. Access to two beautiful putting greens and some really good players for some feedback. And all of us are golfers, you know, or not all of us, but most of the people that work for us, we've got almost 40 of us now. One of the things I always hated about the golf business, was that everybody I talked to in the golf business hated golf. They were over it, you know, like they were frustrated by it because they couldn't, you know, they couldn't play and they want to play and you want to maintain your, you know, your low handicap and you want to be able to compete every once in a while. And they're in the business. They don't have the time anymore. They still expect to play good. They don't. And then they just end up kind of bitter at the game. Matt, my chief operator and I just always, you know, have made it a priority to support everybody's golf. Because if they're not passionate anymore, then we're not going to be
what's the point? Yeah, company
we can be. So we do. You know, we leave early a lot to go play. There's a Tuesday night league here that almost everybody in the building plays in, and
it's awesome. Sorry, I'm going to move myself here. Keep going.
And then come spring, we're going to have a lab specific little Thursday night game out here so that everybody can play. And it's great. It's a really, really great spot.
It's amazing. Sorry, I'm moving because my kids are going to come home from school in about 5 seconds, I think, and they're going to start making tons of noise.
How are your kids?
I want to make sure I'm not all noisy. All right, come down here. So have you been were you an equipment junkie, you know, from the outset? Yes.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Have always been obsessed with gear, putters in particular. And I was always been a pretty strong ball striker and hit the ball a long way and not particularly straight. So, you know, a lot of my game is scrambling and and I was notably streaky. And when I say that, like everybody says, like, oh, I'm a streaky putter. And like, I really was actually streaky. Like days I would putt and blow your mind. And then the next day I just wouldn't. And I got really obsessed with putters. I think by the time I got that Directed Force Reno, I think I had 50 different putters. And I was always bending them and tweaking them and regripping them and adding weight and taking weight away and, you know, just doing all these different things that, you know, now 6 years later in the torque world, like I realized what I was chasing, like and what the difference was day to day and why I'd have my Rossi 2 out there and hold the world. And the next day I couldn't roll it into a swimming pool from 3 feet. And so the answer is torque. And you know, when you have an instrument that is trying to twist out a square, trying to, you know, actively work to be anywhere except where you want it, it takes a lot of management. And the things from a physical standpoint that contribute to that management are pretty infinite. Grip pressure, ball position, and tiny little margins on this stuff. And,
yeah,
you know, where you're gripping it on the putter and all these different things are going to completely change your relationship with how that putter torques. Then you miss a couple putts, and then now it's going to change your relationship with how you're looking at the putter. And you know, if you're an equipment junkie or any of the equipment junkies out there know, like, then you just start chasing. And I was in a perpetual state of chasing to the point that I was intentionally, switching putters every single round, even if I had putted well the day before, just so that I could kind of always manufacture a honeymoon period with a new putter. And, you know, that got pretty tedious and certainly not reliable in competition. And so I got the lab putter, and it's not like this all came. I didn't figure all this out, you know, week one, but over the course of that first year of experiencing it, I really started to realize that torque was the culprit in almost every struggle that I had. And additionally, the culprit in every struggle that I saw everyone else having, from, you know, it is such a snowball effect, of messiness when you're trying to manage the face, and it, you know, the impact that it's going to have on the way you stand over the ball, to your rate of transition, to your tempo, length of follow through, backstroke, all that kind of stuff. When, you know, with other, you know, what I call stroke sports, pool, bowling, darts, shooting a free throw, things like this, you never think about the instrument. Like, you're never thinking about managing the instrument. You're never thinking about, you know, managing your palm when you're throwing a dart. You're not thinking about where the angle of your palm is, you know, when you throw. You're just thinking about a target. Why isn't putting like that? Why don't we just focus on a target and roll it at it? On the days that we're putting good, which means the days that we have a really good relationship with how the putter is twisting, we get target oriented and we make a bunch of putts. On the days where we don't have a good relationship with the putter, all of a sudden our focus is down here rather than out there. And we putt shitty. And so, the putter really, you know, over the course of a year, I mean, the my journey with that putter just, made me realize we are totally doing it wrong. And what Bill invented is correct. It is just absolutely correct. And it's mind-numbing to consider that the game's been around as long as it have, and nobody thought to make the putter stay square. You know, like, it's not great. It's just such a, you know, if you're like talking to a non-golfer, you know, and you explain like, yeah, you know, we make these putters that stay square by ourselves, and nobody else does. Which one are you going to use? They're like, I would think the one that stays square by itself is better. It's like, yeah, it's not tough.
I mean, we talk about squaring the club face. I mean, every club face in the bag, but you talk about squaring up the putter, as opposed to what you're saying is, well, it is square. You stroke it. It's doing the job.
Right.
Let the club do the work.
Exactly. It's a total no-brainer. And it's really fun these last couple of years where I'm not the only one telling that story anymore. You know, we've got a whole army of folks that are just over the moon with the technology, and the vast majority of them are having the same experience that I had. And those that don't have the same experience simply didn't give it enough time. Because if you do, people just don't go back. They just can't go back. Once you feel and really start utilizing lie angle balance and just letting gravity do its thing, you pick up your old Newport or whatever, and it'll feel like a rubber hose. I mean, it's just so difficult to putt with those things. I do every once in a while just to kind of remind myself and reestablish my appreciation for torque free putting. And you know, like, no. What's interesting is that all of the education that I've received, and all the research that I've done and experimentation that I've done with lab, actually makes me use conventional putters much better than I used to. The revealer device, you know, when you actually get to see firsthand how completely false the narrative about, you know, toe hang and face balance and all this stuff is, and you put them in a revealer and see what they actually do, which then tells you at least intellectually what you need to do to compensate for what the putter is trying to do. I'm able to putt, you know, reasonably well with a torquing putter. and sometimes it's really fun because I'm still nostalgic, you know, like I used to have all these 8802s and, you know, cool blade putters. Yeah. Stuff and I love them, and I love the way they feel, and I love the way they sound, and so I'll, you know, I'll break one out every once in a while, and I'll roll, you know, roll a couple of nice putts with it those first three holes, and then it's always some version of the same putt, somewhere from 6 to 10 feet, sort of an off-speed putt where you either need to float it or, you know, or hammer it or do something a little bit different than just make, you know, your regular old stroke. Relationship with the putter changes. I can feel a twist in my hand, and fuck this, it just sucks. So they really do what they say they do.
How has it felt to be, you know, a proselytizer basically for this product, and then obviously be part of the company, and then to have that validated over time by other people, whether that's an influencer level or just an average person, average golfer?
Oh, it's everything to me. I mean, that's the thing that keeps it going for me. I don't have, you know, like if we owned like an iron company or something like that, where there hasn't really been any particularly significant technological advances in a very long time, but I was trying to say, well, you know, we have this 5-step forging process, or ours look really cool or whatever. There's no chance that I could still be passionate about this 6 years later. But the adrenaline that I get when I see somebody, you know, you said proselytizing, you know, see the light and find it is just such a rush, and it never gets old. It's been a while now, and it never, ever, ever gets old. It turns me on just as much every single time I see somebody's eyes light up. And their brain starts spinning on like, why is this only now happening? And it's also challenging because, to continue with the proselytizing analogy, like a lot of people don't want to have their minds changed. A lot of people don't want to think about things differently. And, you know, I've gone out there with some pretty bold claims. I mean, my assertion that the narrative around, stroke types and what kind of putter you should be fit into based on that stroke type, I'm out there saying that it is patently false, like not even close to true. Like I've seen people, you know, tell me emphatically, you know, that if you have relative to what, I don't know, more gait and more arc, that you should have a toe hang putter. And if you're relative to what, I don't know, more square to square, then you should use a face balance putter. I've heard people tell me emphatically that that's what is. I have yet to see the study that proves it to me. And it's not as though there aren't plenty of people that could. It's just like, and it was actually Ping that came up with the narrative. And I'm not arguing that people react differently to different torque profiles. Sure. I'm just arguing that the commonalities between this stroke and this putter type are not what the industry would have you believe. And so I'm out there saying that, and we've got some serious gurus who make a living off of that narrative. So I get consequently a lot of adversity. I make people angry, you know, not so much the regular old Joe Blows, you know, they're a little bit more open to it, but one of the most important experiences I had, which sort of solidified, you know, my passion and belief in what I'm doing, and what the company is doing, and we had just started to kind of get out on tour and follow those guys around. There was a top putting coach out there who had been very polite to us and, you know, somewhat complimentary on, you know, the the technology. We had just recently come out with the B2 as our blade model. And he went out of his way to come across the green and tell me how much he liked the putter. And so I'm thinking, me and this guy, we're tight. We're doing it. This guy gets it. That same day, a top player who was one of his students came over and was interested in the blade. So I emailed the coach after my interaction with the player. And I said, hey, so-and-so's been, checking out our putter. If you don't mind, put in a good word for me. And he writes me back and he says, while I appreciate that your technology is another option, out there in the world of, ways that putters balance, I've tested this player a million times over and he positively needs a full toe hang putter in order to perform his best. And further, Sam, I have to say, I do find, your revealer demonstration to be a little misleading, because it's not as though a putter face or a putter head has so much torque that we can't mitigate it simply by putting our hands on the putter. And I was quite literally devastated. It absolutely crushed my soul, because I had so much respect for this guy. And I just started questioning myself. And I'm like, am I just out here like believing my own bullshit? Like, did I just fall for some kind of like snake oil and like whatever? And I'm just like, it was just spinning and spinning and spinning and so upset by this. And then I literally woke up in the middle of the night, like straight up, shot up out of bed and realized, like, wait a second. If you're saying that torque is so easily mitigated simply by putting your hands on the putter, then why does this player positively need a full toe hang putter? You've been fitting for torque the whole time. You tell all of your players you need this putter, you need this kind of putter. The only difference between them is the way that they twist. So you can't tell me in the same breath that torque doesn't matter while also saying that this one player positively needs this one kind of putter. And that's when I realized, like, I'm alone. I am alone in this journey. I'm not going to get help from the gurus of the world. They, in fact, don't want to have to change their narrative. They don't want to have to rethink the way that hands go on a putter, or the way that putters move in transition. And so it both reinvigorated my passion for what it is that I do, but also made it very clear that I've got a long road. And there's nothing in the world more difficult to do than to change somebody's mind.
Thank you again to Sam for joining us on the show. I really enjoyed having him. Like I said, we're going to have him back on again. We'll do more on the Bagroom podcast. And then again, if you want to listen to the full interview, it's available at the Bagroom podcast and on golfnewsnet.com. It's going to do it for us this week on the 19th Hole Golf Show. Thanks so much for taking some time to listen to the show and really supporting what we do. It means a whole lot. If you listen to us through a podcast platform that lets you do it, would you consider giving us a 5-star review? Leaving a comment helps us reach more people. If you have questions or comments for me, email is easy. If you want to keep it private, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. If you want to make it public, Ryan Ballingy on Twitter or Instagram. We'll be back with another show next week, and we'll have plenty to talk about, I'm sure. Hope you have a great week, everybody. We'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.